James, if you're in trouble, if you're in any kind of trouble, the first number you want to call, you want to look under the L's.
Mm-hmm.
Lowell, Abby Lowell, who is representing today, among others, Lisa Cook of the Federal Reserve, the Attorney General James of New York State, John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor, and others. He was deeply involved in the efforts to get the illicitly appointed U.S. Attorney in New Jersey and Virginia. And Abby, you have done this for a long time. You have worked as a defense lawyer, chiefly against the Justice Department and many administrations, Republican and Democrat. How different, or is this Justice Department different than the others?
Well, the Justice Department is very different, but let's start with the broader question that you really are asking. My practice and those like me, I have challenged excess of administrative agencies and administrations all the way back, believe it or not, to the Reagan administration. One of my first cases was suing the Federal Aviation Administration for trying to change the flight paths at National Airport. So going after government agencies is not new for me and the folks I work with. The difference is that the excesses of a government used to happen once a year, twice a year, and now it happens once a week. And so it's not like this is a new practice. It's more like this practice needs to be applied literally every other day. As to the Justice Department, you've never seen a Justice Department like this. This Justice Department makes the Justice Department that worked under Richard Nixon look like it was the Justice Department that worked under Ed Levy or any of the other real attorneys general.
Right, yeah.
I mean, to actually use the word justice in this administration for that agency is a misnomer. Think of it this way. One of the most important parts of this Justice Department was that they created, this is not a joke, George Orwell would love this. They created a office called the Office of Weaponization. If that's all you needed to know, then you know what's wrong.
With Ed Martin, one of the most unqualified, he couldn't even be confirmed for the U.S. Attorney in Washington.
What does it say about, given that the United States Senate will do everything that the president asks and do it every way he wants them to do it, that even that couldn't get through?
Couldn't get
Senate,
through.
Right?
You know, we want to talk to you about some of your case. Lisa Cook, Federal Reserve Board. They used this guy at the Federal Housing Authority, or rather he used himself, Bill Pulte,
right,
who really is a kind of an unsung villain in this administration. A lot of people don't know about him, but he's bringing a lot of these awful cases on the behalf of Trump. This isn't about what Lisa Cook did, is it? It's about,
it's not about
the Federal Reserve Board.
You're raising something that's really important. I want to stop there first, as I did a question before. You're right that people don't understand what Bill Pulte, the head of the Federal Housing Finance Administration, is doing. But let's stop there, because sometimes when we talk about the rule of law or the need for democracy, it may be esoteric. This is not esoteric. This agency was put in business to try to make mortgages affordable to Americans and to try to make the mortgage process work. It wasn't supposed to become the mini FBI. It wasn't supposed to become law enforcement. And part of this Trump administration is weaponizing everything, including this agency. So to start off with Bill Pulte, ironic because his family has been in the housing business, gosh knows what they've done over the years to be in charge. You're talking about the fox looking at the chicken coop. He has turned this agency into one of the weapons. So what he did was, the first one, I think, was to our client, Attorney General Letitia James. Then he has made another criminal referral for Lisa Cook. He's also done one for now running for Senate Congressman Eric Swalwell and Senator Adam Schiff. As to Lisa Cook, it's just something that is playing to Trump's power grab. He wants to have control of the Federal Reserve Board.
So this is the same excuse.
This is, but he'll do that. I mean, he'll, you know, he wants to get revenge against Letitia James for bringing a lawsuit and finding him liable for fraud. He uses one of the agencies. He wants to claim power over the Federal Reserve Board. He'll use this agency. He wants to maybe make it more difficult for Eric Swalwell to win in California. He'll use the agency. Each of these fit a pattern. But as to Lisa Cook, it couldn't be clearer that this was, he first attacked Chairperson Powell. Then he went after her. This is all his plan because he thinks he wants to control the agency that for over 200 years from the original First Bank of the United States has set monetary policy, which the Supreme Court even has left as its own special place in administrative law. He wants the interest rates to go down. You could debate that, I suppose, although every economist knows that getting quick free money only creates a problem down the road with inflation.
Happened in the 70s with Arthur Burns caving in to Richard Nixon.
Yep.
James Carville. So counselor, you're not just one of the most esteemed attorneys. You also teach at two very highly rated law schools, Columbia and Georgetown. If a student said, Professor Lowell, all of us have to honor a subpoena when we get one. And we have our clients and you get a subpoena, you got to honor it. Yet the Clintons just got a subpoena and they're not going to honor it. What makes them above the law? Why do we have to do something and they don't have to do the same thing?
So the students asking that question would have the following answer.
Right.
Subpoenas, the way they are supposed to issue in life, are supposed to have a correct process, a procedure.
Right.
So the subpoenas that went out in August, including the Clintons, were done by the entire committee, also the Democrats. The subpoenas that went out that is now the subject of controversy with the Clintons and Comer were done by himself in December with no other committee member involved.
Oh, wow.
So to begin with, my students should know the phrase due process,
okay,
or any process. So that's one reason. The second is a subpoena that comes out of a court or comes out of a process may look different than one that comes out of the desk of a Republican MAGA chairperson. That doesn't mean that it's not valid. It could be valid, but it doesn't mean that it shouldn't be challenged as being invalid. And one of the reasons you challenge it for being invalid is that every subpoena that's ever gone out by a congressional committee leads to negotiations. It won't be for 12 hours. It will be for 4 hours. It won't be for every topic. It will be for one topic. It won't be on Monday. It will be on Thursday. And that committee hasn't wanted to engage. The Clintons have made all kinds of overtures to say, we'll do it this way. We'll do whatever. Here's the best thing I would tell my students. The chairman issued 8 subpoenas. 6 of them were for people that were the attorneys general, the U.S. attorney who made the deal with Jeffrey Epstein, an FBI director. All the people that are involved in why didn't you investigate Jeffrey Epstein correctly? The other 2 went to Bill and Hillary Clinton, who had nothing to do with the investigation, but are the great foils whenever the Republicans want to have a distraction. So you don't have the right to simply say a subpoena on itself doesn't get challenged. Ultimately, you may have to comply, but not before testing whether it's valid.
And there was everybody knows that in any committee, you say a religious law, whatever. I mean, there is certain due process, even
right,
in the congressional.
Right. So here's an example. People say, oh, what about Steve Bannon, who got held for contempt and was convicted? Steve Bannon told the Congress to go pound sand. He didn't negotiate. He didn't engage. He said, you don't have the power to do this. That's not what the Clintons have said. They said, late, what do you need? What can we give you? They've actually submitted sworn affidavits answering the main question. So I don't know what to say, except if my student asked me that, they'd get that 5-minute lecture.
Well, now it was a good lecture, Prof. I wish I'd have been in your class. So this is something that you've been practicing criminal law for a long, long time. And every time I talk to experienced criminal lawyer, they have horror tales about prosecutorial overreach. All right. And what are some of the more egregious things that you've seen in your practice?
Over the years?
Yeah.
So this issue of prosecutors having too much unchecked power is not a phenomenon of 2026 or 2025. It has existed in other places. I can give you 2 great ones. One is a guy named John Edwards, who was a senator from North Carolina who I represented, ran for president, and during that time had the lack of judgment to have a relationship with a person, not his wife, and that got exposed, et cetera, and turned into a scandal. And a prosecutor decided, you know what? I am going to take what happened and turned it into a federal felony by calling his friends that helped him in that period of time, not with campaign money, but their own money, working for the person, helping the person with her needs, to be an illegal campaign contribution. Never, ever, ever something that the Federal Election Commission had considered. And indeed, the FEC chair people that we had as witnesses said it's not a campaign contribution. But a single prosecutor, by the name of, by the way, Jack Smith, who's ironic, right, decided that he was going to create that. Prosecutors aren't supposed to make law. They're supposed to enforce the law that's already been existed. So I said in my closing argument to the jury, and I'll say it again here, there's a difference between a sin and a crime. The other thing I said during that trial to make the point was I pointed out to the jury that on the witness, there were 2 books in the courtroom at all times during the trial. On the witness stand was the Holy Bible, and on the prosecutor's desk was the criminal law. And I pointed out to the jury, those books have never been in the same place at the same time. That's prosecutorial overreach. Another area of prosecutorial overreach doesn't actually get to prosecutorial overreach, but another case I represented somebody on was in that awful, awful event of the disappearance of the young woman named Chandra Levy. And I represented Congressman Gary Condon, who was the subject of whether or not he was the one to have harmed her, killed her. As it turns out, she was murdered. The government, the prosecutors, and the police were so intent on keeping the focus on him that they let the real murderer get away. There are things that prosecutors do that cater to politics, the public, their image, and those don't always have the right checks. Those are just two examples.
You know, when you talk about prosecutorial overreach, about 25 years ago, James and Paul and Benjamin and I went to a prize fight in Las Vegas. And we had lunch with the mayor, Oscar Goodman, who I had gone to school with. And Oscar was a mob lawyer before.
I know Oscar well.
And Paul at one point asked him, how did you get this one guy off who everybody knew was a really, really bad guy? It's easy. Prosecutorial overreach. So the FBI does things they don't have to do. They could win cases, but they become so obsessed. Remember that, James?
Oh, no, forget
it. I couldn't agree with you guys more. Go ahead.
I asked Mayor Benton, I said, would Senator McCarran as corrupt as Senator Gary in The Godfather? You know, his answer was, oh, no, McCarran was much more corrupt.
Oscar said that?
Yeah. He said, oh, no.
What a piece of work. Let me ask you about another client you have, which is really interesting. John Bolton. John Bolton was the very conservative national security advisor for Donald Trump, Trump 1.0. They're now, have brought an indictment against him. Talk about that case and what you think it really is all about.
Okay, so begin with, you know, prosecutorial overreach and the president's venom isn't necessarily unilaterally one party. We'll go after all of his enemies one way or another. And certainly one enemy has been John Bolton, who even he at some point had enough in Trump 1 and wouldn't agree with the president doing what the president was doing. So there he went, and life went on, and he wrote a book. President tried to stop his book by saying it wasn't properly pre-cleared when it was. And then all of a sudden, he is the subject of a search over the summer where somebody in this Justice Department decides it's time to look at that again. So the motivation isn't from, oh my gosh, this has been the crime of the century that's been sitting there for 5 years to be examined. It is based on, we're going to go after the people that somehow the president
didn't. Get even, get back.
As to the case itself, the argument is that he improperly kept and disclosed classified information in the way of his diaries. It's not about his book anymore. It's about diaries he kept. And it's a very unusual kind of claim because what we know is, for example, President Reagan kept primary diaries and he left them on his coffee table in his house in California. And others, Zbigniew Brzezinski kept diaries that he used to write his book. There's an issue about whether any of those diaries contain classified information. That's what will be the trial about. But people should know what this case is. It's not that John Bolton did something and leaked it to the press. It's not that John Bolton did something and leaked it to an ally or even an enemy of the United States. It's that John Bolton wrote diaries from what he was doing every day. And the government says you shouldn't have kept them afterwards and you shouldn't have shared them with your wife. Hardly the crime of the century.
But Abby, you know, you as you said, prosecutorial overreach is not unique to this administration. There were others, but this is there's so many of whom you represent that he's going after. Trump is politically going after John Bolton, not because he's worried about what he had in his diaries, because he wants to get him. Right. He's going after James, not because of a mortgage thing, because he wants to get her. You know, same thing with Lisa. I mean, have we ever seen him as pervasive as this?
No, you've never seen anything as pervasive as this in the history of the United States Department of Justice or the tools that they have, at least as far as I know, as I've practiced or I've studied. This is a unique moment. And you know it's unique, too, because while the attorney general does what the president wants, the attorney general can't do it all by herself. And what have you seen? You've seen real prosecutors and real FBI agents who have worked all of their lives as career people to serve the United States, quit, leave, refuse to carry out these improper orders. There are so many fewer people in these Department of Justice agency divisions that there were before. You know, you can tell there's something wrong that when the people that have been willing to serve multiple administrations have decided enough is enough and I'm leaving. So, no, it is unprecedented.
Justice Department officials, former ones, have told me that the personnel there, you know, the longtime personnel, among some of the great lawyers that they've ever known, people who could be making a couple million dollars in private practice, but they're so devoted. And they're the ones you're talking about that are leaving or being pushed out.
There are people that have literally been there for 10, 15, 20 years who finally either refuse to carry out an improper order or don't want to be put in a position to do that and have left. So, you know, there's something unusual going on about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, let me tell you before you ask me the question, here's one ray of hope. Here's one good news that comes out of this bad news. Let's use Attorney General Letitia James's case. So they were able to kick out the career prosecutor, put in a completely unqualified friend, personal lawyer, President Trump called Lindsey Halligan. Insurance lawyer. She was put in for one purpose, which was to go bring an indictment against James Comey, the FBI director, and Letitia James. She did it by herself. She went into the grand jury. She was improperly appointed. They tried to go around the Senate's advise and consent role. We can talk about that as well. Bottom line is, on that day, somehow she got one grand jury to do that. We challenged, we won, we showed that she didn't have authority. The case was dismissed. It got a lot of publicity. The world started to know what was going on. They tried two other times to go to different grand juries to get Attorney General James indicted. Two other times. In my practice, James and Al, for decades, there has never been a case where I am involved when a federal prosecutor has asked a federal grand jury to indict somebody and the grand jury said no. Now two grand juries
said no. Even ham sandwiches, right?
That's right. The old expression, you know, a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. Well, apparently they can indict a ham sandwich, but not Attorney General Letitia James. The good news is the founders put a grand jury in place coming out of common law England as some form of protection between the state and the individual. Mostly that is warded away over the decades. This is the resurrection of that protection because it's never happened before. That's a good piece of news.
That's great. James.
So, Abby, it's a true story. My best friend, you all, and it's just some 10, I don't know, maybe 12 years ago, I went to his house for Christmas Day, and he a very successful landfill operator, and he was being investigated by the U.S. attorney in New Orleans. He said, you know, James, I think I'm going to go down there. But and explain to him, I said, you're not going any fucking where. This is Brendan Sullivan's phone number. You don't talk to anybody. And it the way it ended up, they all resigned. They just dropped the case. And Brendan Sullivan told me it was worse than the Ted Stevens case, which is like legendary.
It is legendary. You know, the Ted Stevens case was prosecutors so much wanting to get Ted Stevens that they hid evidence from him and his defense counsel.
Right.
And that ended up the demise of that case. So,
So is there any, because people listen to this and you never know, is there any way that you would advise someone to talk to the government without first having advice or counsel?
I think this is a pretty clear rule for the history of the law enforcement apparatus in the United States, let alone in any other country. There is, you'll appreciate this. I used to work closely with a country lawyer in North Texas who also practiced in Oklahoma. The first time I met him, I went into his office. And above his desk, he had a wide-mouthed bass on his wall. And there was a little plaque under it. And the plaque said, if I hadn't opened my mouth, I wouldn't be hanging here today. I think that's all you need to know.
Yeah, I used to get a lot of times, I mean, remember when Democrats, you know, somebody get appointed and the FBI would call and they'd do a kind of a bullshit interview. You know anything? I wouldn't talk to them unless I called a lawyer. Just to know that, you know, did George Stephanopoulos, did he have any, you know, most insane shit in the world. I don't talk to them for nothing.
I mean, you know, look, the founders did some really good work in those 10 years, and one of which was the Fifth Amendment, which they understood provided protection against the state overreaching. And so when you don't have to open your mouth because it could cause what they call self-incrimination, I just think the system works in a way in which you put a lawyer in the room with the person that needs to be spoken with. Let's put it this way too, James. The government's lawyer is in the room. Why should a person who the government wants to talk to not have that person's lawyer in the room? That's all you need to know.
You know, Joe Ellis, the great historian of the founders, told me the other day, he said, the founders really wouldn't have liked Donald Trump. And I said, why? And they said, well, they hated King George. So why were they going to like King Donald? One encouraging thing, I think you've alluded to this. Boy, you're at the top of this list. The lawyers have risen to the occasion. There have been more lawyers. I mean, I'm going to leave out the New York law firms who I think have acted disgracefully. But I mean, you and so many others are involved in all of these cases, and you are holding them accountable, and you're winning a lot of these cases.
So the lawyer issue here is a complex one, right? Lawyers are supposed to do more than look at how much revenue they can bring into their firm. Lawyers played a unique role in American history. People forget, by the way, that John Adams represented the British troops were accused of murder in the Boston Massacre.
Yeah.
He got them acquitted, he ran, and he won the presidency. Lawyers play a very unique role in protecting the rights of everybody in our country. And that's supposed to be the foundation of why we do what we do. Sure, we can make a decent income doing it. But that, you know, you want to make a decent income, go in private equity. There's supposed to be something that a lawyer does that's different. That said, there are three groups of lawyers. There are the law firms that got targeted and made a deal, and it's kind of disgraceful, but maybe you could say, okay, I get it, but that's just not becoming. They're the law firms that fought back, some of the big ones, and there are a handful, and they're showing us the way it's supposed to happen. I'm concerned about those many law firms in the middle, who neither were targeted, nor did they crawl and make a deal, but they're so scared to death that they have ceded the field and not doing pro bono work that they used to do.
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands of hours of pro bono work because they don't want to take the risk. People in the communities who aren't getting that free service are the ones that are affected by this. And then there's folks like I and others, and there's a bunch of us that have tried to say, okay, we're not going to be in any of those camps. We're going to, you know, engage, figure out what we do, and see if we can't be part of the solution and not part of the problem.
You know, Don Verrilli, the former Solicitor General, tried to get those law firms that didn't, they just weren't involved, to sign a petition.
To join in the challenge.
The overwhelming majority declined.
And they overwhelmingly
declined. Because they were afraid.
Well, I think that there's a lesson here, and I think the good news is lawyers will rise again, but it will separate those that should and those who should not.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a great lesson.
Well, you're on the right side. Abby Lowe, it's terrific to have you.
So, yeah. So, so much. James.